Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I was writing stuff for food. I was on the copy desk. I couldn't get attention. Cheryl was going on vacation, and I convinced them to let me fill in as food editor for 1 week. And it was several months hence. Cheryl said, I'll just line up stories for you, and you can. I'll tell you what we're going to do, and then you can just edit them all. And I said, could you do me a favor? Don't line up anything. I'll handle everything.
We are back with Washington Post food editor and cookbook author Joe Yonan. You've written 2 cookbooks. You've edited a third. You've shepherded the Washington Post into the digital age. It's crazy. it's pretty impressive.
Oh, thanks.
You know, it's like when I did my research, I was like, wow, man, Joe's done a lot of stuff.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. For coming from you, that's actually quite the compliment.
So you're in Boston. You've transitioned to the food section.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then what made you decide to go to D.C.? So what year are we talking about?
So we're talking about 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Globe in 96 and left in 2006.
Right. The year I launched Serious Eats, as you know, because you read Serious Eats.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I had worked at the Globe for 10 years at that point. I had been travel editor, and I had done a stint where I remade a lot of sections at the Globe. That was actually how I ended up getting them to put me in food. Is if anyone's listening and you're able to do this, make yourself indispensable and then threaten to leave. That is how you get people to try to give you what you want, or at least to pay attention. So Marty Baron was at the Globe at this point. He was the one that really paid attention to my desire to be in food. He's the one who made me travel editor. But there wasn't a position, really. So first—
Right, because Cheryl Julian was the longtime food editor, right?
Cheryl Julian was the longtime food editor. Allison Arnett was the restaurant critic. There were no other positions. So first I said, I got an offer— an outside offer after making myself indispensable doing all these other things. And I said, I'm going to leave unless you put me in food as a writer. So Marty put me in food as a writer on a 6-month basis. And then the 6 months was up and he tried to move me back. And so I just did the same thing again. So I just got another offer and I said, I'm going to leave in this, but this time it has to be permanent. You have to put me in food. So they put me in food permanently. And it was great for a couple of years. And then I really wanted to be the food editor.
Right. And you were blocked.
I was blocked. And I was used to revamping things. And there were things that I wanted to revamp about the section.
There's a woman at the Times who just retired, Trish Hall, who was in, I don't know if you knew her. She was the revamping king queen of the New York Times.
Yeah.
Real estate, travel, food. She had all those sections.
It's so fun to do that.
Yeah.
It's super fun to do that. And I really couldn't do that. And so when the job at the Post came up, I just said, you know, I really want to do it. I mean, it also was more resources, bigger staff. You know, I thought naively at the time that the Post was in so much better shape than the Globe was. The Globe at that point was really cutting. It was a lot of—
Yes.
Marty was managing decline. It was very difficult. Morale was in the toilet. And I looked at the Post and it just seemed like this promised land.
The Graham family still owned the majority of the stock, even though it was a publicly traded company.
Yep. That's right. The Graham family still owned it. Len Downey, the wonderful Len Downey, was the editor. Phil Bennett was the managing editor. And when I went for interviews, they couldn't have been nicer. They were just the nicest, nicest people I had ever met, honestly. And Boston, you know, Boston people, by contrast, are not always known for being nice. And newspaper people in general
are not the friendliest, warmest people.
Right. And I was this Southern guy who was, you know, relatively gregarious, and I always felt a little out of place in Boston. I have wonderful friends there, but I always felt a little bit out of place. And D.C. felt like the South.
Yeah, because I mean, it is.
It's below the Mason-Dixon line. It is. I mean, when I was growing up, I thought that D.C. might as well have been Canada, right? Like, I had no...
Right.
You know, I had no clue. But from being in Boston, then I was like, oh, yeah. And so, yeah, so I went to the Post in 2006 to edit the food section.
And were you given carte blanche? Because one of the things that's interesting about that year for me is it was the year I launched Serious Eats. And the changes were being felt in the food culture and in food media.
Absolutely.
That blogs affected.
Absolutely.
And were you conscious of that at that time? Like at that moment, were you thinking, I'm going to steer this into the digital age? Or were you still thinking, because a lot of people like at the Times were like, it's not still not news till we write about it.
Right, right. You know, Ed, I actually really remember, and I don't think I'm exaggerating this. I remember your advice having something to do with my mindset back then, because I remember we were still in touch after we had gone on the pizza crawl, and I knew what you were up to with Serious Eats. And yeah, and I remember we had conversations like, I remember you told me about Twitter. I mean, you didn't tell me
you didn't break
the news about Twitter to me, but I remember asking you, I was like, you know, I don't know. Like this, should I bother with this? Should I bother? And you said you absolutely should bother.
Because I met Twitter's co-founder, Evan Williams, who's now started Medium. He was partners with the first temporary CEO of Serious Eats, a woman named Meg Hourihan, and they developed the first blogging software, which they sold to Google. So they were both millionaires by the time they were 30.
Right. Amazing. Amazing. And I remember asking you, and not just about Twitter, I remember you were saying to me, do it, and here's my advice, have personality, have fun, don't just put things out there. And I remember talking to you about digital media because I remember, and we would talk about the Times some, and I remember saying I didn't want the Post to be like that. So yes, one of the very first things that we did when I got there was create a real recipe database that people could search for recipes, and we put thousands of recipes from our archives online and tried to create a space where people could come and filter through the recipes.
Yeah.
That was one of the first things that we did. Now, the problem is, as much as I thought that the Post was so much better situated than the Globe, of course, all the same factors were at play. The Post was just a few years ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So within a few years, it felt like I was right back where I had been at the Globe.
But you were limited in what you could do to sort of move
the food section forward. That's exactly right, because we were making a dime on the dollar, the Post was, for advertising. The digital advertising was paying a tiny fraction of what the print advertising was
paying. It still makes one-tenth as much money for the same number of impressions.
Right. So we're trying to grow the website, right? But it can't grow fast enough because at that point we didn't have a paywall. So we're trying to grow the website fast enough to be able to increase the ad rates because we had more viewers, fast enough to make up for the drop-off in the print
advertising in
circulation, right? So it's this horrible
problem. It's the ultimate catch-22.
Right, right. And what happened was the Graham family is trying to distinguish the Post. So what can we do? What is it that can set the Post apart from other papers? And one of the things that they did was say, okay, you know what? The Washington Post is going to be 100% for and about Washington. So it was double down, triple down, quadruple down.
Super serve
Washington. One of the things about the Post when I went there, I don't know if this is still, this is probably still true for the print side, that the Post was known for was it was the highest circulation paper that had the level of market penetration that it had. We had a much deeper market penetration than the Times. So like the percentage of people in the D.C. area that subscribed to the physical Washington Post
was huge.
Higher than any other city in the country.
Yeah.
But obviously there's problems with that model. And it took Jeff Bezos and Jeff Bezos' purchase of the Post to really help everybody realize that.
Right. And it's interesting because one of the things that the Graham family did is they decided to diversify, right? So they bought Newsweek.
Yes, exactly.
They bought Stanley Kaplan, the test.
Oh, man.
Remember
that's right.
That stuff?
Oh, I tried to forget that, Ed.
But it's like many other publicly held but privately run,
right?
Like the Times. All the attempts at diversification failed.
Right.
It must have been difficult trying to shepherd this food section, knowing what's going on.
Yes.
And knowing that there's only so much you can do until Bezos bought the paper and what he did. And he's a complex guy. We don't need to go into that stuff. But he must have put the wind back into your sails.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And yes, he's a complicated figure, but he invested smartly in the paper, in engineering and development, and he lifted the shackles of the for and about Washington mantra from the paper. And we wanted this. It wasn't like anyone, you know, was arguing with this. We all wanted it. I was doing national food stories as much as I could. I was like finding little DC angles to slip in to national food stories to try to make sure that nobody noticed.
You were finding the loopholes the same way you found
exactly.
the loopholes when you went shopping for your mother.
That's exactly right. I'm a loophole guy. But he made us realize that the only way to survive was to build scale. So, and the only way to build scale is to appeal to as wide of an audience as possible, right? So that's what we started doing again, and to really focus on scale. And also one of the big things that we did that we had never really done was pay a lot more attention to the digital headlines, to this. There was more of a social media strategy. It was all before
right.
that.
And
it was
all. Right, and they gave you... A lot of papers, there would be this divide, like, okay, you run the digital food side, and you
right.
run the print food
exactly.
side. It's like, that never made sense to me.
No, it was terrible. When I first went to the Post, the website was across the river, Ed. It was a different division
yeah.
of the company.
And it's crazy.
It was crazy. So we had merged before Bezos bought us, so we were sort of prime for this. But yes, when I first went there, I would edit a story. A reporter would write a story and just the story and send it to me. And I would edit just the text and I would send it along to a copy editor and they would write a headline and a photo editor would find a photo and put it on it. And then once the website started getting integrated, we had these production editors who would try to dress it up. Well, guess what's happened? I mean,
right.
now it's basically back to my old days of community journalism. I do everything now, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Like, that's how I want it. Like, I mean, I have a photo editor
yeah,
and we
yeah.
have photographers and
we have people.
I have people, but I'm still putting the package together now.
Yeah.
So, and it makes me, you know, I need to think about who is this for? What audience is this for? How are we reaching them? Are we positioning this story to get an audience through search, through Google search, or are we positioning it to be passed along through social? Are we trying to do both?
What's fascinating is you're not an entrepreneur by inclination, and yet you found yourself doing entrepreneurial thinking within
right.
the confines of bigger organizations.
That's right. That's right. I just don't get maybe the payoff that
yeah.
you might get if you were a successful entrepreneur
well,
like you.
I don't know
you.
About that. It was crazy. And I don't think you want to live through what I lived through. So somehow you found time to write a cookbook called Serve Yourself, Nightly Adventures in Cooking for One in
yep.
2011.
Mm-hmm.
Which you didn't take a leave, I believe. I can't remember if you did, or maybe you did just a very short one.
Yeah. yeah.
And what I found so interesting about the cookbooks is they're in their own way quite personal and revealing.
Oh, yeah.
It's like you didn't shy away from it. what's it like cooking for one?
Right.
And is it lonely? Is it not lonely?
Right.
And I assume it has to come from your personal experience. It has to be autobiographical.
Yeah. Yeah, it totally was. Well, I'm married now, but I was single for a really long time. And one of the things that I wanted to do with that book, which sort of grew out of a column I was writing for the Post, was really say to people, it actually can get kind of emotional, but to say to people, you know what, you're worth it.
Like, right.
You people would always say to me, why would I go to all the trouble to cook for myself when it's just me? You know, and I always would say, why wouldn't you? I mean, you're the most important person,
right?
To cook for,
right?
But yeah, so I tried to really try to inspire people to have fun and think about it in a different way. But also, yeah, I didn't shy away from this. Don't get caught up in this idea that you're not important enough.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Really try to celebrate yourself.
And even for the second book, which is 2013, which is Eat Your Vegetables, it sort of talks about your path to vegetarianism.
Yeah.
And you did take a leave. I remember talking to you about it. It's like, I'm going to go live with my brother in Maine. You know,
and my sister and brother-in-law. Yeah. 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 And it was amazing.
And you went up there and you were actually gardening. Right.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
Were
they. Yeah.
Raising growing vegetables.
They grow almost all their own food on an incredible piece of property. You should really try to see it sometime.
Really?
I would totally send you by there if you're ever in the. My sister would love to meet you.
It's in Maine, right?
In southern Maine, in North Berwick. It's about a couple hours north of Boston. Went up there partly to work on the book. I had this. Well, I had laid somebody off at the Post. It was the first time I had to actually have that conversation.
Probably the most painful thing you can do.
It's the most painful thing you can do. And it was around budget time. And I thought to myself, I don't want to be here during next budget season. I can't do this again. Simultaneously, I had just had a really traumatic experience where my beloved dog died very suddenly and unexpectedly in my apartment. And then at the very same time, right around the same time, the only place that I really was finding any solace at the time was this community garden I'd been in for a few years. It was this beautiful 20-year-old, all organic, 80-plot community garden. And the landowners decided to live up to the Joni Mitchell song and to pave paradise and put up a parking lot.
Wow.
And I didn't want to be at work. I didn't want to be at home, and I couldn't be in the garden. And I was like, I have to get the hell out of town. I have to.
Wow.
And so I was simultaneously talking to a 10-speed about another book, and I just was like, I want to go live with my sister. We're very close, and I want to go live with her, and if I can't garden here, I want to learn how they do it. And so that was why.
Which is even harder in southern Maine, given the climactic conditions.
Oh, my Lord.
So you actually took a leave, because I remember you appointed a temporary replacement for you.
My deputy editor, Bonnie Benwick, took over the section for a year. And, yeah, they made it all work, and I walked away. And I still wrote, was it monthly? Yeah, it was monthly. I wrote a little recipe.
Dispatches from Maine.
Yes. Single cooking, not really for yourself, kind of with other people. Yeah.
What I realized in doing the research for these episodes is the personal stuff you sort of save for the cookbooks more than anything you wrote in the paper. And I don't know if that was conscious, probably from what you're saying. It doesn't sound like it was conscious.
No, it wasn't.
Maybe you thought that didn't belong in the paper or...
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't really ever thought about that before. I think it might have just been... I feel like I dabbled in it in the paper maybe, but I think it probably was just that I didn't have time to write anything of length in the paper. I don't think I thought that it was inappropriate for the paper. Although, yeah, it's interesting. Not inappropriate in general, but maybe not like there wasn't a natural home for it
in
what I was editing in the food section. Like, how do I make these connections?
Yeah.
But I think part of it might have just been that I was, I didn't have time.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't
for sure.
until I like was working on the book that I felt like I had time to do it.
You know, one of the many ways our lives have intersected over the years is one of the first people I hired at Sirius Eats was Erin Zimmer.
I know, she's so great.
Who was the greatest, and she immediately established her bona fides with me by saying she knew you.
Yeah.
And you were I think you were even giving her some assignments.
Yeah, I just started.
And now Elazar, who works for me,
yeah,
at
that's
Sirius
right.
Eats is now doing you were very, you know, because people always talk about, you know, how did I find all these people? It was really through people like you and through blogs.
Yeah.
And it was also the only people I could afford.
Right.
You know, it's like you read the book, you know, like Kenji was like, what am I doing?
I couldn't believe that.
You know, it's
like, oh my God.
This guy is paying me $35 a story and I'm putting my life in his hands.
Man. It's worked out okay for Kenji. But
yes,
yeah.
It's worked out okay for Kenji, but it's also, and I don't know if you feel this way, and I say this in Serious Eater, and by the way, thank you for all the kind words about the book.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
But it's like the greatest, most unexpected pleasure I got from Serious Eats was finding young, talented people and giving them the runway they needed to become whatever it is they could become.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you feel that way about the section.
I so do. You know, Ed, when I didn't say this when we were talking about the Boston Globe, but, you know, when I decided that I was going to go to culinary school and change my career toward food, I reached out to the two staffers in food at the Boston Globe. One of them did not respond. And I was working at the paper, mind you. One of them did not respond. And the other one, remember, I was working nights. The other one said, quote, don't quit your night job.
Whoa, nice. That's supportive.
Yeah. I was happy to, at one point, become, at least for a short period, one of those people's boss, which was
sweet.
Which was sweet. But I really vowed then that I would never do that to people.
Yeah.
That if someone reached out to me that I knew had an energy and an interest in food journalism, I would try to give them some of my time.
Yeah.
Now, you know, and I'm sure this happens to you, I do get a ton of people asking me that. And it's impossible to give everyone a lot of time. But I try to respond to everybody, and when I do find people that I think are interesting and that seem like they have some talent and they want to put in the work, that's another requirement, that I really enjoy working with them. Elazar is a joy to work with.
Yeah, and he's like 21 years old.
He's so young!
By the time he's 30, I think he's going to be the boss of both of us.
I know, probably.
But it's okay. It's fun. When I sent you the copy of the book, you actually responded and said, oh, it's great. So I have to ask you, what resonated with you?
Oh, man. Well, I think I told you it's so much more dramatic than I had expected. You know, from the outside, and even though you and I have talked about these things, I certainly wasn't privy to, you know, all of the angst and the crises that you were facing all the time. I think for me, what resonated was, you know, the passion and the drive to make something work in the face of all of these obstacles. I mean, just
insane. One
obstacle after another. And, you know, just the commitment to keep going and making it work no matter what happened, I thought was fascinating. And the fact that you were, I mean, honestly, it's just every chapter is a cliffhanger because you were always on the cliff.
Exactly. It's like I always say I was never / raising money.
Right.
You know, and so it really was one crisis after another. And as you read about, it was my wife who literally I was going to continue. And then she was just like, no mas.
Right.
You know, I can't
right.
do this anymore. So anyway, I'm so glad that you liked the book because it was, you know, I'd never written a book like that before. And like the idea that I could write a coherent book-length nonfiction narrative.
Right.
You know, I felt like, you know, like you're like, I think you're much, you know, I regard most people as much better writers than me.
I don't know about that.
But I just was so amazed that what came out was coherent.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And at first it's like, I hope it doesn't suck. And now I actually think it's pretty good.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that feeling right before it comes out, especially when you're like, am I the only... I have this feeling everything I've written where you think, am I the only person who is going to get this? Am I the only person who thinks this is cool? Maybe I'm wrong and it's really bad.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So, all right, now it's time for the All You Can Answer Special Sauce Buffet.
Uh-oh, I should have studied it.
Nah, there's no reason to. So, who's at your last supper? No family allowed, so your husband can't be there.
Okay.
Your many brothers and sisters who are still with us, none of those people, because the people would just say their family.
Writers. Nina Simone.
Nina Simone, you already earned a place at the special sauce permanent table.
Honestly, do I need to even have anyone other than Nina Simone? I mean, if Nina Simone is at the table, I sort of feel like I don't know if anybody else needs to be there because I just am going to want to talk to her.
God, Nina Simone. You know, in the book, as you know, I was a worked for concert promoters for a few years, and we actually did some Nina Simone shows. And
you get to meet her?
Yes, and it was really difficult because Nina Simone, if you saw the documentary,
amazing documentary.
You know, had many issues.
Yeah.
But when she was present and singing, it was the world had stopped.
Magic.
It was like magic.
Magic. The tone of that voice,
and
I could hear her
and
forever.
And the way she could penetrate anyone's psyche.
Yeah, absolutely.
With seemingly simple lyrics.
Yeah, absolutely. Just stunning.
Yeah,
absolutely stunning.
So I don't know. I think I may let you off the hook.
Okay,
I may let you have a dinner for two.
Yes.
And then you can write a cookbook about dinners for two.
Dinners for two with me and
Nina. With Nina Simone. So what are you eating?
What am I eating? Oh, at this dinner.
Yeah.
Oh, we're at the dinner. Oh, God. Okay. Wow.
You could have somebody cooking for you, or you could cook it yourself. So
I could have somebody cooking for me. If I could have somebody cooking for me, I think I probably, why wouldn't I have someone cooking for me? Who is that? Wow. This is a very difficult question. I mean, of course, I want to ask Nina what she feels like eating as a host, right?
It's
like, I want to make her happy. I want to make her happy. Can the person who's cooking for us also be dead?
Sure.
Well, it's at Edna Lewis. I want dinner by Edna Lewis with me and Nina Simone.
The Special Sauce Hall of Fame by conjuring up Nina Simone and Edna Lewis, the famous African-American cook who was incredibly influential and is seemingly every few years gets another moment in the sun.
Right.
Somebody writes another bio, somebody updates a cookbook. You know, it's like, and I think it's happening now. I think I got some press release. There's something about happening at the Museum of Food and Drink in Manhattan that's related to Edna Lewis that I don't remember.
They're reissuing In Pursuit of Flavor.
That's right.
Which is the first book before Taste of Country Cooking. And there was a beautiful anthology out that I had a piece in called Edna Lewis at the Table, I think.
Yeah.
Edited by Sarah Franklin. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want Edna Lewis because I never got to eat Edna Lewis's food directly.
I did once at Gage and Tony's.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And I was like, you know, this place is a tourist trap. And I didn't know shit at the time. And then I was like, this is good. You know, like,
that's so great.
Yeah, I mean, she was the chef there for a couple of years, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's awesome. So what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
Oh, tacos.
Tacos.
Yeah.
Because you always have tortillas.
I always have tortillas, and I always have cans of beans, and I always have eggs, and I always have sweet potatoes, and I often have pickled onions in the fridge, and I always have salsa that I've made. So I make tacos I roast sweet potatoes or microwave them if I don't have time.
Yeah.
And I cook a fried egg, sweet potato, pickled onion, salsa taco is kind of awesome.
It's like your West Texas roots.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have a guilty pleasure?
Oh, I don't really believe in the guilt, but...
Okay, that's good. Besides our mutual fondness for Mr. Goodbars.
Yes, yes, Mr. Goodbars. I like everything. Like, I don't... what is something that's sort of lowbrow that I like? I like... Well, you know, I eat bivalves. That's one of my exceptions. I eat oysters, mussels, and clams because I don't think they're sentient and other reasons. but I really like smoked oysters out of the can.
That's good. Well, you know, there
it's
are whole,
lowbrow.
As you know, there are whole tapas restaurants in Barcelona that serve only canned seafood.
Yeah,
I know. It's and I went to one. It was awesome.
Yeah.
So, what's on your nightstand now, book-wise?
Oh, what's on my nightstand? Well, Serious Eater was just on my nightstand.
I brought it with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not lying. This is not just for you. It really was. I was trying to read it. Not trying to read it. I was enjoying reading it. There's a book, My Lovely Wife by Samantha Downing is a book that I got because it was recommended for people who liked Gone Girl and The Woman in the Window. I've sort of been getting into those. Sort of thrillers lately.
Are you a Laura Lippman fan?
I have been,
yeah. You know, she's my wife's client, and I'm reading new book, which I think is called The Lady in the Lake. I could be wrong.
Oh, yeah. No, I think
it's great.
Is it great?
It's amazing.
All right, okay, I'll get it.
She's from Baltimore, so,
Yes, of course.
Some people call Baltimore, Washington one market. I think it's definitely two markets.
Definitely two markets.
So, who's had the greatest influence on your career?
The greatest practical impact? It feels horrible to say this, but it's Marty Baron.
I was going to suggest that.
I mean, it's Marty Baron because, you know, when I was at the Globe, the story that I didn't get to tell a little bit earlier, I'll try to make it quick, is that I was writing stuff for Food. I was on the copy desk. I couldn't get attention. Cheryl was going on vacation, and I convinced them to let me fill in as food editor for 1 week. And it was several months hence, and Cheryl said, oh, I'll just line up. I love Cheryl, by the way.
Right.
Cheryl said, I'll just line up stories for you, and I'll tell you what we're going to do, and then you can just edit them all. And I said, could you do me a favor? Don't line up anything. I'll handle everything. And so I ended up doing this crazy reader cook-off, sort of Iron Chef style, and it was a production. We actually did it at my culinary school,
That's
and we photographed
awesome.
It and wrote about it, and did this huge package. And Marty really loved it, and he gave me a shot at being travel editor after that.
That's great.
You know, if that hadn't happened, I don't know, you know, where any of this would have gone.
And now he's at the Post.
And now he's
and
at the Post.
And, of course, people know them from the movie Spotlight.
Right. He's really, honestly, the best editor on the planet, what can I say?
Yeah.
He really is.
He's a friend of my brother. I have a brother who's a conductor who somehow became friends with Marty Baron. I don't even know how. But, okay, so it's just been declared Joe Yonan Day.
That is so nice. I didn't know you had the ability to do that, Ed.
All over the world.
Wow.
So what's happening on that day?
Wow. What is happening on Joe Yonan Day? Oh, my God. Okay. Well, people are eating completely plant-based for this day.
I don't know. I might have to rescind this question.
Okay, maybe you could add some cheese.
Okay.
Cheese, but people are eating a lot of beans. Ed.
Okay,
beans. That's
good.
That's my next book.
Really?
It's about beans. Yeah, my next book is about beans.
Awesome.
Coming out in, next year, but people are eating a lot of beans. People are listening to a lot of really great music. They're listening to a lot of Nina Simone.
Awesome.
Just to take us back. Amy Winehouse. I'm curating everybody's playlists for the day.
Is it?
So that's
Didn't
fun.
You love the fact that they let me put in a Serious Eats playlist?
I love that. I really wish that I had taken the time to download the playlist and listen to it while I was reading it. I may have to do that.
It's pretty cool because actually what Penguin has done is they've created the Serious Eater playlist on Spotify.
Oh, that's great. So I could just grab it.
Yeah, you can just grab it. So, wow. Okay, this is really cool. Well, I can't tell you how much fun this has been. And just because you named Nina Simone and Edna Lewis, for those reasons alone.
I'm so glad.
This has been a great time. So thank you for sharing your special sauce with us.
Oh, Joe Yonan. Thanks for having me.
And by all means, subscribe to The Washington Post, even if you don't live in D.C., because it is worth every cent to subscribe to The Washington Post. I say that as a subscriber, and it's really important, actually.
Good journalism is not just worth paying for, but it needs support.
Yes, exactly. And just buy one of Joe's books, and we can't wait for the Beans Cookbook to come out.
Thank you.
It's really been a pleasure. And so long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.